Morning. May it please the court, Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant, Justin Erskine. There are two errors in this case. One occurred when the trial court failed to provide the jury with a correct statement of the law of accomplice liability and failed to provide the jury with the instructions necessary to follow that law. The other occurred during the prosecutor's rebuttal, which implied that defense counsel colluded with the expert in this case to provide an opinion favorable to Mr. Erskine.
I wanted to ask you a question about the first issue, and it's a hypothetical question. I know that's not our case. But let's suppose in my hypothetical the record reflected that the defense attorney said unequivocally, I don't want any 274 instruction. My client's charged with accomplice liability. I want you to give an instruction on accomplice liability, but I'm absolutely convinced the state has improved its case on accomplice liability to first-degree murder, so therefore, I want it to be all or nothing. That's the hypothetical.
Yes.
Could that be done?
Your Honor, I gave that some thought as well, and I think the best solution I would say to that would be, it could be, but I think that it would have to be discussed with the client himself, and perhaps as the court did in Perkins versus State, a colloquy with the defendant himself that he's willing to give up those particular what's mandated analysis as to his individual culpability in that case.
Well, that's why, as you know, Chance was a plain error review. And in this case, I looked at the transcript, and what we see, the defense attorney says this is on B18. I haven't seen the court's instructions on accomplice liability yet. That's what he says. Mm-hmm. But I'd be interested in seeing the instructions on accomplice liability. But then the state goes on to talk about the argument. But we've recently held in the last 6 months that when we're looking at plain error, we're not going to look at plain error if there was a strategic choice to do something. And so my question is, why isn't this issue best sorted out under Rule 61 to decide whether this was a strategy and if it was an appropriate strategy rather than in a direct appeal on plain error when it appears, based on the argument to the jury, that perhaps this was a strategy?
Well, Your Honor, this is the correct point in the procedure to address this, and that is because the language of 274 and 271 are mandatory, and under Chance, it was a plain error. This court has stated that the jury must have this analysis presented to them.
Right, you're right. It's mandatory, but I think our subsequent cases, at least so far, have simply said mandatory on request. Now, Chance was a little different because Chance was talking about lesser included instructions in a different context. But I think a fair reading of where we are now is if you're charged as an accomplice and you want a 274 instruction, you're entitled to it. But we haven't gone so far as to say, in the absence of a request, every time there is an accomplice liability, you must charge you must instruct on all lesser included offenses if it's a crime that's divisible into degrees. We haven't said that yet.
Now, how does this play out in the other case law related to this issue? And the reason I ask this question, so it's not a mystery question, the tension always is we have cases that say the jury and I assume the parties are entitled to a correct statement of the law.
Correct.
And we have precedent that says it's mandated that this charge be given.
Correct.
And you have a trial judge who, A, doesn't want to interfere with whatever strategy the parties have adopted and doesn't make an inquiry into whether there's a waiver of that mandated charge here in order to develop on the record some position of the defense on a strategy. And the defense, one could argue, sets up a situation to have it both ways. To not ask for the charge and then later, as you're doing for the defendant now, argue that it was error not to have the charge or error for the judge not to give that instruction to the jury. Now, I, for one, am sitting up here saying this is a crazy quilt. There's got to be some solution to this mess, because it is a mess. Cases say it's mandated, but is it like a constitutional right that can be waived? How do we know, after the fact, what the defense strategy was? There's no inquiry of the defense counsel. Where do we go with this mess?
Well, I think this kind of plays into what Mr. Wallace's argument was. There's three statutes we're dealing with. 206 deals with the lesser included, which is where the party autonomy line of cases came from, which deals with the strategy of the defense attorney and not interfering with that. Then we have 274, which is what we're dealing with here, which never discusses party autonomy and strategy reasons. It says it is mandated that this instruction be given. So I think we can reconcile the two by saying when we're in accomplice liability land, this is mandatory. Now, with respect to, you know, it's not the same as a constitutional right, well, I think that the reasoning behind the 274 analysis is that each individual has the right to be judged based on their own culpability. So that is a very, you know, it's not...
Well, why isn't it analogous to a constitutional right?
Well, I'm saying it is analogous.
So it can be waived.
I believe it could be. But I think that in this case, in a situation like this, you know, he can't waive a jury trial right unless it's knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, and he signs the waiver. This is something I think in Perkins versus State, I think the judge didn't have to do it, but she went above and beyond and did a waiver with the client. I think that would be appropriate here. Because in this case, for example, we have circumstances where the defense presented a duress defense. And on the surface, it looks like it would make sense for an attorney strategically to do all or nothing. But when you have the circumstances in that case, and as reflected by what the jury told the court, those circumstances, while the jury may not have bought the duress defense, are significant in determining his culpability. And they were restrained from doing that. So they were stuck in a situation where the law said...
Well, when you say they were restrained from doing that, I'm not sure I understand what you mean. The defendant arguably opted for a trial strategy that never put that issue directly to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would disagree that there was an option there. We can't tell that from the record. It's silent as to that, whether there was a strategic decision or not. And so to decide, given the past case law...
Well, why wouldn't we assume that counsel knows the law and knows that there are cases that say that charge is mandated, or at a minimum, as Justice Holland pointed out, knows that if he requests it, it's mandated that it be given, and counsel doesn't request it?
Well, alternatively, we can also assume that the judge knows the law. He never raised that as well. Not putting this on the judge, but I think there's equally a situation there where it was just unfortunately skipped over, which goes to...
I think that's a good point. You would have thought by now, after everything this court's written about 271 and 274, and that whenever you're talking about homicide and you're talking about accomplice liability, somebody would have said on the record, what are we going to do?
Right.
Is there any rational explanation on why that didn't occur?
The rational explanation would be that it was overlooked by all parties. And that takes us to the Rule 61 issue, which I believe would be viable. But I do believe when this court has the opportunity and it sees that there was an oversight at this stage and the law was not given to the jury correctly.
But the difficulty with focusing on oversight is if you look at the argument to the jury, the argument to the jury by defense counsel, although it was related to defense, basically was you can't find my client guilty of first-degree murder. There's no intent. It reads like an all-or-nothing argument.
Correct. On the surface, he says murder first degree. I don't believe he addresses, you know, the others because it's not in the offense. Once the instruction is not given, he's going to argue consistent. Let me state that differently. There were no lesser includes given, so therefore he's not arguing the lesser.
I understand that, and that's why I started out by asking you the hypothetical, because it seems that you're saying he adopted his strategy once lesser included were not given. The other argument is he He knew the law. He made a conscious decision to make it all or nothing. And our question is it something that can be waived? And if it can be waived, is that what the defense attorney was doing here? And as I said, if it's strategy, it's not plain error. And if it's strategy, that gets developed on a Rule 61.
Right. But I believe that and I understand the court's recent decisions with respect to plain error specifically. But this court made clear, Chance at the very least, that in that case, which was plain error, that it was plain error because even though it wasn't requested, the law is mandatory. One other case that pops to my mind recently is the Waters versus State, where neither counsel objected to the reversal of the closing arguments. There was no objection. And the court looked to the rule with respect to the arguments and said this is mandatory language, so it must be reversed. And when there's mandatory language in a situation like that, there must be, it must be given. And if it's failed to be given, that's when you have the plain error. Now, can it be waived is another issue, which I believe, according to the way we deal with constitutional law, I believe that would be a right that is within the defendant himself, that he understands that he waives that affirmatively that right that he be individually assessed.
Well, if the defendant doesn't request any lesser included offenses as part of the instructions, isn't that to be equated to, I don't believe there are any facts in the record that would support anything other than intentional murder or not guilty as a result of duress?
I believe if it's silent, we can't make that assumption. And one of the reasons in this case that that assumption can't be made is because the state did give a plea agreement to the principal of murder second degree. So they were aware that there's at least some basis in fact for a murder two conviction, because there has to be some basis in fact for them to offer such a plea to somebody. And
well, they wanted that person's testimony.
Correct.
You know, this is shopping in the marketplace for testimony, not so much a focus on whether the facts suit the crime or not. Here, are there any facts that would justify an instruction under 274? On the theory there's some lesser degree of culpability shown by the facts in this record.
Certainly. In this case, there was testimony regarding, for murder two at the very least, there was testimony with respect to the duress defense, which basically talked about he was following along in this situation. He had nothing to do with the original shooting. He was silent the entire time. This person was barely alive at the point that his involvement came into place, and the principal was going to bury him. Was it reckless for him to be there to hand him the knife and try to get himself out of the situation that way under cruel, wicked circumstances? I believe that's something the jury could conclude. Clearly, the jury, in its note, found that he had some lesser, some of the jurors, I should say, that he may have had some lesser degree of culpability. And the sentencing part of that, the fact that they wanted the sentencing to be less than life in prison, is significant because that's the whole point behind this accomplice liability and culpability. Culpability drives the sentencing. So if they found that he had less culpability and less of a sentence, so there had to be facts just evident by the jury's note, and respectfully, even if they're shopping for testimony, the prosecutor cannot in good faith make an offer that's not based in fact. So there had to be that, and there were circumstances clearly presented by Dr. Mechanic, which even if the jury did not find find that it amounted to duress, created circumstances where he put himself in this situation recklessly and didn't know what to do at this point when Mr. Hamilton was going to bury this person alive. So that in and of itself could provide the jury with some basis. Whether or not that's what they would conclude, you know, that's an issue for them.
Let's move to your second argument involving Dr. Mechanic. And the judge gave a curative instruction with regard to bought and paid for. You seem to contend that it was inadequate. Is that because the state pounded this theme too frequently, or that the instruction was inadequate in and of itself?
Well, both. Well, actually, I'd say the first. There wasn't just one statement of bought and paid for. If, in fact, that was the only statement, perhaps the curative instruction would have been sufficient. There was at least four different sets of statements the prosecutor used in this case that indicated that, in one case, stated that Dr. Mechanic knew what defense counsel wanted to present when he did the interview, when he did the report. And he knew that when he put the word duress in the report itself. So we have more than just a comment, bought and paid for. We have a series of implications being made that he knew from defense counsel, look, this is what I want. Give me this. And that's what he gave. And that's problematic here for a couple reasons. One is that Dr. Mechanic, his credentials, and he survived with his credibility intact. But also, I believe it's worth noting, is that the state uses Dr. Mechanic a significant number of times. And for the prosecutor to have a good faith basis to make some kind of inference that the doctor would work with the counsel, that would be disconcerting to arrive at an opinion that he wanted.
Well, I don't think anyone will disagree with you that it's a problem. The question is, the trial judge, before the jury went into deliberation, at least as I read the record, instructed them by way of a curative instruction, cautioning them to disregard those comments. Why isn't that sufficient?
Well, actually, before they went to deliberate, I believe he addressed the red herring comment that was made. The next day, I believe, if I have this correct, is when he addressed later he addressed the comment of bought and paid for.
Had they been in deliberations?
I'm sorry. No, they weren't in deliberations. I apologize.
That's what I thought. I thought he gave the instruction in regard to the bought and paid for before they went into deliberations.
Yes, I apologize. But he simply stated that, you may recall, and he's bringing it to their attention again, that in the last argument, at one point, the prosecutor referred to Dr. Mechanic as the defense's bought and paid for expert. So it is inadequate because it did not address, it's not just the comment, it's the theme that the prosecutor was presenting to the jury, that he, in fact, was colluding with defense counsel.
Do you want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, good morning. Paul Wallace on behalf of the state. I'd like to answer Justice Holland's hypothetical first. The answer is yes, absolutely. When a defendant is charged as an accomplice, he has the right, under the party autonomy approach that this state takes, to say, I don't want lessers. I want to go all or nothing. It only makes sense if we look at the party autonomy approach that the court has adopted since first in Chow, then through Cox, and later through Brower. All 274 does is gives a bridge to lesser includeds. It tells the jury that there is a different way to get to it when you have an accomplice.
That in a homicide case, if you're charged as an accomplice and you do elect to exercise your right under 274 based on what we've said, the judge has to give that instruction.
Absolutely. I believe it's the same as any other lesser included offense situation. If there's a rational basis in the evidence, if in fact there it is applicable, and either party, if the defense says, you know what, I don't want it, I want to go all or nothing, and the state says, no, we want the jury to assess your culpability based on mental state, it works the same way the party autonomy rule works in relation to just regular lesser included under 206. It would work precisely the same way. And I think that's a way to synthesize the decisions this court has made. Now, I share the concern that the court does, and that is, why aren't these things made on the record? I share it probably much more now than I do mostly appeals, because certainly I'd like to see that there. I would suggest for the court's attention, when the state took its appeal in State versus Cox, when we first had there was a question about just how strong was the party autonomy rule, and I think that's really the first time the court actually mentioned it by that name in 2001, The briefing of the state had set forth what we believed may be the appropriate steps to take in trial. And I would suggest that perhaps that that may be a reminder to the trial courts. We do believe that these should be discussed during a prayer conference. Why? Because then we're not here guessing. Then we're not wondering whether or not we have to go to Rule 61.
I think the difficulty is here. And it's one thing to have party autonomy, but I think I'm surprised every Superior Court judge in the state considering a first-degree murder based on accomplice liability wouldn't say, what are we going to do about 274? I mean, that's got to be in every case. And then the defense could say, I waive. But it's just hard to believe that after all the cases we've written about accomplice liability and homicide, and homicide's always the example, that someone here wouldn't say, what are we going to do about 274?
I agree, Your Honor, and I think, especially being as in homicide, it came up first in Chance. It was pretty clear. I do not believe that the court can impose the lesser included over the party's wishes. I think that they should have that conversation. I think that both parties should make their own determination as to whether they wish to go all or nothing. I don't believe that 271 and 274 mandate those lesser included to be given, and that that bridging instruction as to how you get to the lesser included is any greater than 206.
Your policy argument there may be the best argument, and one might want to agree with it, but what do we do, certainly as a panel of three, about language in earlier precedent that talks about the mandate?
Well, I think if you look at the cases in which it came up, Your Honor, if you look in Chance, lesser includeds were given. The problem was that bridging instruction. That's what's mandated. The parties had already decided they wanted lesser includeds in Chance. So, too, in Allen. In Allen, the defendant already said, I want the lesser includeds, and I want you to give me that bridging instruction, that 274 instruction.
So you're suggesting that if we read all the precedent carefully enough, we'll see where each of those earlier cases involved a situation where there were instructions requested and given about lesser included offenses, and the only remaining issue was whether the 274 bridging instruction was given.
I believe so. My reading of the cases, Your Honor, is precisely that. And on the flip side, the fact that when we look at how the court has dealt with people who may have a right to a lesser included but who do not ask for it, the normal 206 type instructions, this court has time and again said, well, you waived it. I mean, if you didn't ask for it, if you didn't want a lesser included, and in fact in Chow, that's what happened, she specifically said she didn't want it. But after Chow, if you look at the cases where defendants claim on appeal, it was plain error for the court not to give the lesser included. This court has always said, well, you must request it. And I'd suggest that that should be the same rule here. I think contextually, to try to look to see what was happening in the courtroom at this time, I think contextually, if you see how this had played out, the fact was that Erskine had gone through two attorneys. He had decided he didn't want anything to do with any type of lesser plea or anything else. He was arguing duress. He was arguing all or nothing. I think perhaps it was in everyone's mind, this is not somebody who wants lesser included, and the state was willing to go all or nothing also. Would it have been better had they had that discussion? Absolutely. Do we suggest that perhaps in the court's opinion here, that might be a reminder to the courts that I suggest both 206 and 274 type lesser included should be discussed in the prayer conference. That way, if there's a waiver, it can be done. I don't believe that the waiver, and I'm looking at cases from other states, for instance, that sticks out in my mind because it's called Wallace, but it's out of Iowa and it's been cited either by this court or certainly I know in briefing in these issues, that the court, the Iowa Supreme Court, had noted that you can accept the attorney's discussion on the record. I don't know that you have to have a specific colloquy with the defendant to say, do you understand you have a right to lessers? Again, as an appellate attorney and somebody who wants to save the record on Rule 61, that might be better. But because of the nature of those discussions, they are discussions between counsel and the defendant, and the fact that counsel probably would be in a better position to explain to the court, I've discussed this fully, he or she does not want it, that colloquy could happen simply with the attorneys and the court, but that the best practice is simply to do it. And we wholly agree with the court there.
Simply to do what?
To have that colloquy, to have a discussion during the prayer conference whenever lessors are a possibility, to get on the record each party's position as to lessors. Certainly an accomplice where the court has said when they want it, it's mandated.
Well, if I understand you, you're asking us to view the two situations as being entirely analogous. So accomplice liability instructions, lesser included instructions, they're equal. There's no difference between them in terms of a defendant may not choose to go with those instructions, but it's no more of an issue with respect to accomplice liability than it would be with respect to lessors.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That's the state's position. There's nothing textually in the statute that says so.
Isn't there really a difference? If you're talking about 206, you have to have a basis in the record to support the lesser included offense. But if you're talking about accomplice liability, 274, if you want it, says the jury has to make a determination with regard to your own culpability if it's divided into degrees. Now, I understand in your brief you're saying you don't even get the 274 unless there's a rational basis in the record to support it. But it's possible to read 274 as saying the focus should be on homicide and other offenses that are divided into degrees, and you have to tell the jury what the degrees are and then have the jury make the assessment of this individual's culpability.
I suggest not, Your Honor, because what the court would then be saying is that the court must give the instruction even if there is no basis in the evidence at all. And let's step away from 206 and the rational basis in the evidence that's in that statute. In other circumstances, the court has always said, this court's decision in 2008 in Jerren Wright, the court set out what the three factors are before the court gives any type of instruction, lesser included instruction, defense instruction, whatever. And one of those is always there must be a basis in the evidence. There must be some basis in the evidence to find the person, to acquit the person of the greater offense and find them lesser,
but
he's got some different mental state.
You're talking about situations where the defendant's charged with their own conduct, and this isn't some dramatic exception. It only applies when the state decides to prosecute someone as an accomplice. When the state says, our only case against you is as an accomplice, 274 says, all right, someone else committed the crime. We're going to convict you under accomplice liability based on your own culpability.
Your Honor, I'm certainly not going to say that in most cases, there is going to be a basis in the evidence that he has some lesser mental state, only because normally the activity, the accomplice activity as opposed to the principal activity. But this may be that rare factual circumstance because we know exactly what Erskine was thinking. He told the police. This was his own taped statement. I gave him the knife and told him to finish him off. I told him to stab him in the lung. There's no doubt as to what his mental state is. He wants to finish it. He wants to cause the death by his activity. And I suggest that there are going to be those certain circumstances. And just as with other lessors,
if the person who actually carried out the act could plead guilty to second-degree murder, it seems logical that the jury should have the opportunity to convict Erskine of second-degree murder. Or are you saying there was no basis for Hamilton's guilty plea?
I'm not saying that there's no basis for his guilty plea. However, we know that whenever you have, whenever somebody's guilty of murder one, they're automatically guilty of all the lessors. That's what this court's said in its case law. But certainly we do know that there are circumstances where you go to trial, you set forth the evidence, and there may be no rational basis for the lesser offenses. Ayers is one of them.
What would you have said at the plea, at the prayer conference, when the request was for a 271 charge involving second degree? The prosecutor says no, listen to his tape statement. He clearly intended to commit first degree murder. And then the response was, well, Hamilton pled guilty to second degree, and he's the one with the knife. What would you say to the judge? Well, even though Hamilton pled guilty to second degree murder, we don't think Erskine should get that?
In reality, if I was the prosecutor, I would have agreed to lessers in this case, Your Honor. I certainly would have. But that doesn't mean that there's not, that one can't say, look, there is no specific basis in the evidence, and it certainly doesn't come from somebody else's plea. That's
what would you have done if, to follow up on Justice Allen's question, if you indeed said, oh, I couldn't agree more, the jury's entitled to a charge, and so is the defendant, on second degree, and defense counsel, we don't want it.
As the prosecutor, would I have gone all or nothing in this case? I might have. The prosecutors in this case did. I can't say that it's...
aren't we stuck with a record here that makes it more likely than not that the defendant would have said, I don't want a lesser included offense.
Absolutely.
Don't care what Hamilton pled to.
Absolutely. It appears that's exactly what he did. He said, I don't care what Hamilton pled to. I don't care what you've offered me before. I don't care what the court might want to give me. I'm going all or nothing because I don't think I have criminal liability. I don't think I'm culpable for this killing. Unfortunately, he got the all instead of the nothing. He's not happy about that.
What does the trial judge do when he hears that from counsel? And he believes that the record supports a lesser included offense, and that if it supports a lesser included offense, he or she should consider giving 274. What does the trial judge do in those circumstances?
I think the court does the same thing it does in the 206 situation, and that is, Your Honor, it leaves it to the strategic decisions of counsel and the parties. It's the same party autonomy call there. The court might say, I would try this case differently. I wouldn't put all my eggs in the all-or-nothing basket. But in the end, the party autonomy and the lesser-includeds are all basically derived from the constitutional right to be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt and to fully...
Let me make sure I understand this. I'm sitting as the trial judge, and the trial judge says it's true that Hamilton, the state's main witness here, has pled to second-degree murder, correct? And this is a first-degree murder accomplished trial, correct? Doesn't that mean that the defendant's entitled to a second-degree murder lesser-included offense, at a minimum, if not manslaughter, if not criminally negligent homicide? Probably not the latter. But, and the prosecutor says, yes, Your Honor, I think the facts do support that. And then the defense counsel says, but we don't want it. And the trial judge says, but how do you respond to the case law that says when there's a lesser-included offense, or when one's entitled to a charge of lesser-included offense, it's mandated that I give 274.
I'd suggest respectfully that the party autonomy approach, just like it does for 206, the court's equally mandated to give a lesser-included offense when there's a rational basis in the evidence and one of the party wants it. There's no magic language in 274 that makes it any more mandatory than other lesser included.
But under your party autonomy theory, if the state said, which you may or may not have done, and I understand that, we want the second degree charge, would the trial judge then have to give both
yes.
the lesser and the 274?
Yes, absolutely.
So it's not just the defendant's trial strategy making the call.
Absolutely. It's both parties. Both parties, the way the party autonomy rule basically works is if there's a rational basis in the evidence or the law supports it for 274 purposes. If the law supports it, there's evidence of it. The court should only give it if either party asks for it, and either party has an equal right to it. That's what Cox tells us. That's what Brower tells us. If neither party asks for it, if both parties decide I'm going all or nothing, then we go all or nothing. And that's what happened in this case. And the state suggests that that's the appropriate result. Mr. Erskine made numerous bad choices in this case, and that simply was one of them.
Before your time's completely up, Mr. Wallace, let's talk about the second issue. What are the limitations on the ability to argue for either side that a witness has been paid? Is it fair to suggest that they've compromised their professional integrity simply because one side paid them?
I think I'd suggest, Your Honor, that it's the approach that some of the other courts have taken in this, and that is that it may be a fair argument, but that there should be some basis in the evidence for it. And here the prosecutor specifically was basing his suggestion that when balancing things, perhaps this expert paid more attention to who hired him than necessarily what the evidence was in this case, only because there were things that he specifically left out when trying to address someone's mental state and claim that there was duress. He didn't even look at all the defendant's statements. He admitted that on cross-examination. He didn't look at all the police reports. He admitted that on cross-examination.
It's one thing to make the argument in cross-examining. It's one thing to cross-examine an expert and show where they failed to rely on important facts in reaching their opinion or relied on facts that were, in effect, not really facts. But an altogether other thing, isn't it, to argue in your rebuttal when no one has a chance to answer it, that the testimony was bought and paid for, that this was a $5,000 report, and that you used the very word that the defense puts before the jury as an affirmative defense, and it costs the defendant $5,000 for you to say that. That's basically what this argument says, isn't it? It's not about how effective the prosecutor was when he cross-examined on facts assumed and conclusions derived from those assumptions. Time and time again, he referred to it as a $5,000 report, like there's something nefarious going on.
When he did tie, but in that very rebuttal argument, he did tie to the very things that he believed was the weakness in what the expert was saying. Your Honor, I'd put this in the class of the cases, and that's why I discussed it in Hughes in one of the footnotes. It's like the L word. It's not one that you can use all the time. It's not one that maybe you should use very often. But when you have specific facts in the case, just as this court has said, it may be appropriate. And in this case, the prosecutor said, look, you duress isn't even a mental condition. And yet this expert uses duress of all things.
Well, you just said with respect to jury instructions, it works both ways. Suppose the defense attorney was attacking the state medical examiner because the state medical examiner works for the state, the prosecutor works for the state, and the state's interested in a first-degree murder conviction because it's charged, and the medical examiner has aligned his or her interest with the outcome the state wants. I mean, what are the limitations on what a defense attorney could argue?
I'd suggest that the limitations are the same. The ABA standards say the limitations are both the same. May I finish?
Please.
And that is, if you're tying it to specific facts and findings in the case and not general principle that they hired him so he must be on their side, or they work for us so he must be on their side, but looks at specific pieces of evidence or cross-examination in the case that's happened with the prosecutor in this case, then it may be a fair argument. Again, I'm not arguing that it's a one that anybody should pull out, but I'd suggest that in this particular case, he did look to specific pieces that were missing out of the analysis and then said, weigh that against other parts of this case that
well,
you can attract someone's credibility.
Well, when Dr. Mechanic, the state pays him his professional fees, don't they?
Yes. So and if Dr. Mechanic did the same thing, then perhaps it would be a fair argument in that case. It's an individual. I think you have to look at the individual facts of the case and what occurred in that case. If there are no further questions, Your Honor, thank you.
Thank you.
I do question whether the state wouldn't have a problem with defense counsel arguing that the state met with that Dr. Mechanic knew what case the state wanted to put on and that somehow they paid him to actually deliver that case, which is what the language of the prosecutor's argument was. He paid $5,000 to tell you this. It would have been fair to say, address his fees perhaps. Say he testified that he gets paid to be here, and then go into what occurred. But he implied several times, if you look at the language very clearly, that they paid him $5,000 to come here and tell you this. He knew that the defendant wanted a duress defense, so that's why he did this.
Do you think in civil cases in this state where numerous experts testify for both sides in many, many trials, that we haven't long ago overcome the tendency to ask Dr. So-and-so, were you paid for your testimony today? And the response is, that's an improper question. You can ask him if he's paid for his time, but
correct,
not for his testimony.
That's exactly right.
Why doesn't that obvious common sense rule pervade the mind of prosecutors and defense attorneys in criminal cases?
I agree, and that's the same problem we have with the other argument, and it is unfortunate, and it is frustrating, as Mr. Wallace pointed out. We can tell trial attorneys a million times, and they still it gets overlooked. But for the client's sake, what the court needs to look to is whether his case, whether he was substantially prejudiced, and he was in both situations. And just real quickly, with respect to Mr. Hamilton's plea, I do want to make a distinction. Normally, when someone pleads and they get the benefit of the plea, you understand that. But I think as Chief Justice Steele was pointing out, in this case, when that happens, the jury should have at least had the opportunity to consider that. And if they had and reached murder first degree, we'd be in a different situation than we are here. And that's all the argument is they were required to give the jury that opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Please rise.